I've come here to talk to you about a relatively easy problem, I think. Yeah. It's just a very old and ancient problem. This dates back to some of the earliest ancient philosophers. But the question about free will and how it is that we understand our ability, what seems to be our ability to direct our actions and influence the world around us, and our ability to understand how the order and structure in nature. And so, you know, I have about 40 minutes, hopefully, and so I can't claim that I'm going to solve every single problem related to this and put them to rest. What I'm hoping to do is portray an image of a way to think about free will and a way to think about nature that shows a harmony between the two and a possibility of their working together in certain ways. Now, to do that, I wanted to spend a little bit of time just talking about what we mean when we say free will, because that's in many ways sort of an initial problem, because people kind of have different ideas about what they mean when they say free will and different contexts, depending on in certain what their sort of philosophical background is. I think kind of a good starting point is, so I listed a few kind of definitions, quote unquote, sort of descriptions of free will. This first description from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, this article on compatibilism, kind of tries to give what he says this theory-neutral point of view, free will can be defined as the unique ability of persons to exercise control over their conduct in the manner necessary for moral responsibility. And I think this is where the concern and the real interest in the question of free will comes in, because there's a way in which we all feel like and construct our societies in a way such that people are responsible for the things that they do. We don't like it when people harm us, and so we want there to be ways that we can prevent people from harming us. We see certain things done to us as being evil or problematic, and so we want to be able to define that as being something that they shouldn't do, something that is morally wrong, and something that is possible to correct them on, to prevent them in some way. And this is just sort of a basic structure of society in many ways. And yet if there's a fear that if we lose the notion of free will, suddenly there's a way in which the very possibility of claiming moral norms or making people responsible for their actions might fall apart or go away. And so a lot of discussion around free will centers on those questions of what do we mean by moral responsibility? What do we mean by and how do we define a person's sort of connection to their actions? And that's a hugely interesting question. In many ways, I'm not going to get too much into the moral side of free will as much. It will touch on that, but I bring this up because one of the ways that people try and reconcile different questions about, say, determinism in science or a materialist view of the world that says that everything is everything can be reduced to physical laws, and something like free will that seems to be on the surface of it outside of those physical laws or something not subject to those physical laws, is to sort of reorient the way we talk about free will, such that free will is not actually about changing the future. Free will is not necessarily that I have the ability to decide on which particular path between two or three or many to go forward, but that really free will is more about the fact that, okay, there's not some external impeding to the things that I desire. So I have desires, I'm able to work towards them without being impeded in a certain way. There's a subtle distinction there. Or that it's more about the fact that we just don't know. Like it's unclear what someone's going to do. Yes, we have all these great scientific laws that describe things, but we're not good. They're not good enough to predict someone's actions explicitly. And so there's some notion of freedom. And so there's ways in which people, historically, there's different kinds of portrayals of free will that step away from this a more kind of hard notion of the ability to affect the physical world around us and affect future outcomes. And so that's that's where some of these debates come center around. And so an example of this is physicist Sean Carroll on his blog talking about free will. He says, we can be perfectly orthodox materialists. He wants to talk about the world as simply being described as scientific laws. And in fact, he would adhere to a very deterministic way of thinking about the world, sort of mini-world interpretation of quantum mechanics, which says that in fact, if you look at the entire structure of reality, everything follows deterministically. And yet, he says, you can have that and you can have free will. If what we mean by this is that there is a level of description that it is useful in certain contexts, and that includes autonomous agents with free will as crucial ingredients. Which is not how I would necessarily off the top of my head describe free will. But just to get a sense of that, this is the type of argument. Do you notice the title of his little blog post there? It's Free Will, It's As Real as Baseball. And he says it's as if saying, yes, we could describe an entire baseball game by describing the location and motion of all the fundamental particles that are involved in the players, the balls, the bat, the field, everything. But why? We just talk about baseball. It's easier. That's a difficult problem. But even if we could, why would you want to? It'd be easier and more convenient to talk about it as a baseball game than 10 bazillion fundamental particles. And so he makes this kind of connection. A harder stance is simply to make the claim that we don't need free will, that determinism is perfectly fine. That free will is an illusion, and that's okay. We can just learn to we just live our lives and learn to deal with that. And another physicist, Sabine Hassenfelder, makes this claim. And so she wants free will, the definition of free will, to be that harder definition. That free will can only exist if there are different possible futures, and you are able to influence which one becomes a reality. And then she would say, you can't do that, so you don't have free will. So that's kind of a little bit of a picture of how the conversation about free will and what the way people try to define free will, and also then the confusion that can seep in when we talk about free will. Now, what does it mean for me to stand here and wave my right pinky? Like, am I waving my right pinky, or what is my role in the waving of my pinky at this moment? With all the moral implications that come from that. There's a way in which it's helpful to see the range in which people try and talk about free will to sort of define this balance. I mean, in certain ways, there are all sorts of different options about how to describe the world. You can talk about the world as being completely deterministic, and they're not being free will, being completely deterministic, and they're being free will, as being sort of completely random, and they're being free will, of completely random, and they're not being free will. And a lot of it depends upon how people want to define the notion of free will and fit these things together. Now, I'm coming to you as a Dominican. I'm coming to you as a Catholic priest, which means I have certain preconceived notions about what free will is, both in various contexts. And I think there is a robustness and a truth to kind of what I call the sort of the Catholic tradition around free will, both in terms of describing our experience of reality and helping us to grow and to become the people we want to be, and particularly sort of the role that St. Thomas Aquinas has in fleshing out some of those things. So, as a sort of brief summary of kind of a Catholic position on what free will would be. You have a statement from the Catechism of the Catholic Church talking about freedom, particularly freedom of man. Freedom is the power rooted in reason and will to act or not to act, to do this or that, and so to perform deliberate actions on one's own responsibility. By free will, one shapes one's own life. Human freedom is a force for growth and maturity and truth and goodness. It attains its perfection when directed toward God, our beatitude. So in many ways, this is very similar to the definition right before it, minus the stuff about growth and maturity and God. But this idea that we have this ability to reach out and influence ourselves, influence the world around us by our choices. And that is in a certain sense fundamental to the Christian tradition. that there is, that we have a responsibility for our actions, and that also we have the ability to change ourselves and those around us for the better or for the worse. And so that is, in a certain sense, the position and the definition of free will that I want to try and defend and I want to flesh out. But I think it's important to clarify some things about this, because there's a way in which the phrases we you know, the way we talk about this can seem very antithetical on surface to our understanding of nature and our understanding of science and our understanding of the natural world. When we talk about these things, you know, what do we mean by reason and will? What do we mean by sort of the deliberation, the ideas of having, in a certain sense, something you want and then going for it? The idea the idea of having goals, of having desires, and moving forward, these are not things that we include in our standard model of particle physics. When we write our equations, we're not talking, broadly speaking, about the goals or the desires of fundamental particles, and so for various reasons. But so it seems like there's this new thing that's suddenly been imported once we bring man involved, once you bring the human person, this new thing that's completely antithetical to everything we talked about before. Particularly as a physicist, where you'd really like for everything, including biology, to be reducible to physics. It's like everything's a math equation, and then suddenly this other weird non-mathematical thing comes in that seems completely antithetical to what we're talking about. So I want to actually sort of step back and take a look at reality from a slightly different perspective. But first, just to flesh out something about this notion of free will. So just take a moment to think, okay, why are you here today, right now? Why are you sitting in this chair? You know, lots of reasons. Perhaps you heard Father Thomas Davenport is coming. It's like, I'm going to go somewhere else. Perhaps you wanted to learn something. Perhaps you heard a Dominican was coming, and you know those guys are crazy, and so you want to come and prove him wrong. Perhaps someone you would like to know better invited you to this talk, and so this is an opportunity to get to know them better. There are lots of reasons that you might be sitting in sitting in these chairs. In a certain sense, so then you can do the 5-year-old thing and ask the why question again. Well, why? Why do you want to learn things? Why do you want to come refute a Dominican? Why do you want to get to know this person sitting next to you? Well, knowledge is power. Knowledge is a good thing. Truth is a good thing. I want to know more truth. Well, why do you want to know more truth? Why do you want that power? Why do you want to know this person better? We can sort of trace back all of these why questions, and we can sort of keep doing that really annoying thing. And ultimately, with some aspect of exasperation, most likely you're going to end up with something along the lines of, I just want to be happy, dang it. And I think this is going to be like a piece of the step toward me being happy. And that is, in a certain sense, in the Thomistic understanding of will, ultimately what the will is about. The will is the power by which we are ordered to that thing that is good for us, the thing that will make us happy. So the will in man is what allows him to choose to go after, to move towards what will make him happy, or make her happy. And so that's kind of this picture of the will, this faculty. But this idea of inclination towards goals seems odd and antithetical in a sort of scientific picture of things. But I want to argue that it's actually not so weird in a certain way. So let's step back a bit. So let's talk about a cat. So a cat sees some motion and then has to decide, is that something I want to run towards or run away? There's a way in which the cat, so say he sees a mouse. He sees food. He runs after it. He sees a dog. He sees something chasing him. He runs away from it. There's a way in which the cat has a certain aspect of this, immediate goal-directedness. When he sees food, he wants food. When he wants to take a nap, he takes a nap. There's a certain sort of goal-directedness in the animal kingdom, and ultimately towards the growth of the individual, so the kitten growing into a cat, ultimately that cat making more cats, and this sort of this repeated process and this standard pattern that we see in cats, such that we may have never met a particular cat, but we know certain things about it because we just know how cats tend to act. They tend to run. They tend to chase after mice and run away from dogs. They tend to sleep a lot. They tend to procreate. They tend to do these things. So there's a way in which we can see something of this motion towards particular ends, particular goals in the animal kingdom. And you can talk. Okay, so let's step back and talk about plants. You can see something similar. You can talk about an apple seed. So the apple seed, under the right conditions, will grow and sprout. Will grow into a mature apple tree. Will make more apples and produce more apple trees. There is this sort of general process by which this tree works, and there are kind of stages that it goes through. We can classify things. We do classify these things, and we're able to describe the motion towards motion towards sort of something of an end, something of a goal in the way it's working. Think about a rock. Okay, so rock. So those are animals, those are living things. Like, but rock. What does a rock do? Well, you push a rock off a cliff and it goes down. It's like, well, obviously that's gravity, right? But there's this sense in which, you know, if it didn't go down, we'd be really surprised. There's a tendency for rocks to settle down. If you want to talk about it in physics, you talk about the finding the lowest gravitational potential energy. So finding that settled place where it can be. And also there's a tendency of rocks to be sort of solid and stable in a way. So there's a certain resistivity the rock has to being destroyed. You know, it takes a lot of effort. It takes a lot of sledgehammer time to get through that rock. And there's a certain there's a way in which, yes, we can describe that in terms of the chemistry of the rock, but there's a way in which we can also see something of emotion towards in certain aspects. So let's go down even further. So in chemistry, you have all sorts of. The whole chemistry is all built around this notion of, in a certain sense, finding these lowest energy states. You know, you have your sodium, you have your chloride, you bring them together in the right conditions, and they find this lower energy state by giving off tons of energy in salt. There's a way in which chemical reactions are built around this motion towards something. Is this a goal? Is this good for the sodium and chloride to be salt? That's hard to understand what we mean by good there, but there is this consistent tendency towards certain states or ends or arrangements of the natural world. And so we can get down to fundamental particles, right? So you have electrons, right? What are... So it's easy when you think about electron, think about an electron just like it, one electron. Particle physicists love to do this. One electron completely isolated from everything in the world. And that you can get pretty darn close to that at times, but where are most electrons? Most electrons are actually in some weird plasma, either like a star or intergalactic space, but they're actually surrounded by tons of protons. They're actually part of a larger structure that is electrically neutral. And in one sense, like, well, obviously, because it's attracted to the positive charges. And so if there's anything positive around it, they're going to come together, and given enough time, they're going to collect down into these neutral constructions. Most of these, again, are so hot that they're not actually bound into atoms, but they're still these sort of neutral collections and structures of electrons and ions floating around. So we can talk about the way that, broadly speaking, electrons tend towards this sort of arrangement, that being near things of opposite charge, building up larger structures, and with low enough energy, they're very tightly bound to one another. We have atoms. We have the whole very possibility of chemistry built off of this tendency of electrons not to be floating around on their own in the middle of nothing, but actually to collect down into these larger structures. I could sit and talk about particle physics and quarks on that level a bunch, but the point I want to get across is one other kind of fun example, like neutrons. So neutrons, again, you think the neutron isolated from everything, it's only pseudo-stable. It's sort of, after a while, it's going to, actually not very long, it's going to decay on its own. It'll split up into this proton and electron. And yet, when neutrons form part of a larger structure, there's a way in which the neutron can survive for very, very long periods, like much, much longer periods of time. When it's part of an atom or part of a neutron star or whatever other larger structure or collection of protons and neutrons it's part of, it allows it to survive. And there's a way in which, in that case, like it's hard to say, is it better for the electron to be alone or be part of something else? There's a way in which, you know, off the cuff, it seems better for the neutron to be a neutron than not to be a neutron, if you're going to think of what's good for the neutron. And so there's a way in which being part of this larger structure is good for the neutron in a very general sense. And so we can... Say again?
But is it good for the quarks?
That's a good question. No, you can do it. I mean, you can talk about, like, well, when you try to pull a quark away from anything else, it really hates it. And it splits up into other things. So the quarks hate to be alone. So there's a way in which we don't talk about science in this way usually. We talk in terms of the equations. We talk in terms of forces and structures. We talk in terms of fields. But there is, when we look at nature from top to bottom, there are repeated patterns of moving from one state to another state. A lot of times these have to do with energy states or in sort of the biological level with notions of eating and healing and procreation. But there's a way in which all of this this motion towards is inherent in our understanding of nature. And in fact, it's absolutely necessary for us to be able to do science at all. Right? So if there weren't these consistent patterns, we wouldn't be able to have these predictions. So if the apple tree makes an apple that makes an apple tree, an apple seed that makes an orange tree, and then the orange tree makes an orange seed which makes a tiger, it's how do you even begin to sort of like map that out? How do you begin to describe the scientific and orderly structure of reality? There is no order anymore. This consistent motion towards what is, so towards certain states, what is in certain circumstances we can argue are good for things, is actually inherent in the very structure of reality. And it's what allows us to talk about the sciences and talk about and predict what's going to go on in reality. So then so I've been avoiding free will a bunch. Now we're gonna get back into man, but we're gonna walk back through because as a human person, right? So I have this body, and it has, and in a certain sense, it has everything we've just been talking about in it. It has all the quarks. It has all the protons and neutrons and electrons. It has all the chemical reactions. It has gravity working on it. And there's a way in which all of those things feed into and in a certain sense are part of what it means to be a human person, what it means to be this larger structure, this more complicated being, is linked into the working together of all of these layers and levels, and so there is this whole panoply of moving of this pattern of moving towards ends and moving towards certain states within me that you can talk about on lower structures. You can even talk about the individual pieces and parts of me, that the liver tends to do certain things, the heart tends to do certain things, and it's good that it keeps doing it so that I stay alive. So as you walk back up this chain, we see sort of this inheriting of goal-directedness in a certain way at lower levels, making possible the goal-directedness at higher levels. So take the cat, right? So the cat sees the mouse, and it wants to get to the mouse. But it turns out the cat's not heavy. It doesn't actually obey the laws of gravity. So it's just sort of like floating in air. So how's the cat going to get the mouse? It's not. It's sort of pushing off of air. I mean, it'll take a while. Maybe he'll get there eventually. But there's a way in which the fact that the cat is on the ground is good for it. Now, if you throw the cat off a cliff, that's bad for it. There's ways in which these things we inherit can impede what we want, can be bad for us. So cat falling off, you know, the fact that the cat is heavy is bad for the cat that's falling off the cliff. It's good for the cat that wants to catch the mouse or run away from the dog because it has something to push off of. And similarly with the chemical and structural aspects of reality where all of these things are inherent in our ability to if I want to choose to come to a talk and sit and listen to this guy in white talk about free will, I need all of these other things to work together in order to be able to even conceive of, and even to be able to begin that process of working towards this goal I have in mind. And we recognize, in a certain sense, this is all somewhat kind of obvious. It's things we clearly recognize, and perhaps I'm just sort of drawing it out in a way and in a language you haven't thought about it before. But I think that's important to see that this is very familiar, right? This is familiar both on the experiential level and familiar on this on our the scientific level as well. Even if it is perhaps language-wise, perhaps slightly new and not intuitive. But what do we say about our desire for this goal of happiness? And here I want to talk about a deeper understanding of what we mean when we talk about free will in man. So we're back in this notion of I want to be happy, right? So we have this goal that ultimately, if we really all thought about it, there's something in the back, there's something along those lines that I want to be happy. How is it that I get to be happy? And so there's something about this type of goal that's a little bit different than, say, the cat chasing after the mouse or running away from the dog. There's a general sense in which the cat is moving towards a goal, of growing into maturity, of procreating, of doing various things. But it's in a certain sense, it's every cat sort of works along the same level. Every cat reacts to mouses and dogs in pretty much the same way, although you get weird cats every once in a while that do crazy things. And there's some YouTube videos on those, so have fun. But there's a way in which there's this sort of standard order of that. And yet, among human beings, we talk about everybody wanting to be happy, and yet everybody's going in completely different directions. There's a way in which the sort of planning, the sort of reasoning that goes into choosing how to be happy and how I want to be happy is hugely varied. And the reason, an argument for the reason why that is because happiness is really, really abstract, right? Happiness is not a mouse. Happiness is not a mate with which to procreate. Happiness is this general idea we have about something we want that we probably feel like we don't exactly have right now. That will make you know, the annoying aspects of our life less annoying, and the good aspects of our life more better. And so it's this abstract goal we're aiming for, and then we have to sort of figure out what particular things we want in order to get to that good thing at the end. And so this idea that by its very nature there is something intellectual about the process by which we experience choosing what we're going to do. That we have this background notion we might not even be thinking about happiness, but we have to plan out how it is that we're going to do what we're going to have. So, I mean, just take MIT as an example, right? So, for those of you who are students here, why are you here at MIT? Is it because the thing that's going to make you most happy in your entire life is taking exams? I mean, oh my gosh, I just love like sitting in a room for 2 hours, getting asked questions I don't know the answer to. It's awesome. I love that. This is it. It's like, no, this is not like that. That in and of itself is not why you're here. There is something good that you're enjoying here, but most of you are here because this is a stepping stone to something else. You have perhaps some concrete goal in mind, some vague notion of where you'd like to be in life, and you feel like this is a stepping stone to get there. So you're going to have, whether you're an undergrad or grad student, 4 to 27 years of your life here in this place, working towards what you hope will be a stepping stone to something else, and then in the process of this, so it's like what are you aiming for? You're aiming for that degree. So to get the degree, you have to complete certain classes, you have to do certain dissertations. So you spend all of your time doing absolutely nothing but working on that degree and working on that thesis, wherever else. You don't even eat or sleep. I mean, I know that's a reputation, but there's going to be some eating or sleeping involved. There are things you do that are for that the greater good, and yet not directly at it, because it's sort of those ancillary functions we have to carry out, right? So if I'm going to survive long enough for the 4 to 27 years, I need to eat every once in a while. I need to rest every once in a while. I need to take a break every once in a while. And so this idea is that the point I'm trying to get at is that there is this hugely complex network of possible paths that we navigate. And what I want to draw out is that when we talk about freedom, we talk about what is it about man, that what is it that we are able, what do we have control over in our choices? The answer that St. Thomas gave, and I think is very, very convincing, is that it's a very limited subset of all of the things that happen to us and that we experience that are particularly under our control. So for instance, as much as I would like to, I cannot make my liver stop functioning right now. Actually, I wouldn't like that, so it's good I can't do that. But I can't choose to tell my heart to stop beating. I can hold my breath, only for so long, and the body starts to fight. There are certain aspects of kind of the material, and I definitely can't tell that electron right there to stop being attracted to that electron right there. There are certain things that just happen to me. There are certain aspects of being a physical body that just happen and are not part of what falls under our control or freedom. And then there's sort of gradations of this, right? So there are certain things that we have the ability, so like breathing. I can sort of hold my breath for a while if I feel like it's a good reason, but I can't do it forever or I pass out and then I start breathing again, hopefully. So there is a certain aspect of control on the way down, but also there's actually a certain aspect of lack of control on the way down. There's actually a lack of control in a certain sense on the very, very highest. Because St. Thomas would argue that it's actually not possible to not want to be happy. That there are, now we can talk about difficult cases, right? So you can talk about people who have, whether it's maybe masochistic tendencies towards hurting themselves, but there's a way in which, okay, yes, the pain objectively is bad, but there's something that they actually, there's something good they see in that. They think this is a means to them being happy. You can talk about tragic cases of depression and suicide and sort of struggles with that. And these are tragic examples, but there's still, if you look at it, there's a way in which the things that people, most extreme cases where people seem to be hard to and actually are doing things that from an external perspective you would argue are harmful to them, are not making them happy. Usually in their own head, there's something about it that is either escaping something making them very unhappy or leading them to being happy. And unfortunately, these can often have tragic consequences. But there is this sense in which the will, that power we have to go after things that we desire, is actually fixed in trying to make us happy. Trying to take us to what will be good. The difficulty is that we don't know what's going to make us happy. We have a hard time grappling with what it is that will make us happy. And this is where freedom comes in. This is where we start to exercise control. Because we start thinking about what is it that's going to make us happy? What is it that's going to lead us to that what we want? And what is it that's going to help us along that way? And so we have control over sort of two aspects of this. We have the ability to think, to think and consider what is it that will truly make us happy. So the two quotes from Aquinas are kind of I'm going to skip over the first two quotes on the free will, but on the back, I wanted this idea that the way in which the will is moved. This is St. Thomas. How is it that the will, that power by which we go after things we want, how is it that propels us? What sorts of things propel us? And he says there's two ways we can talk about that. We can talk about it as it acts, as it exercises, and secondly, as to sort of the particular thing that we're acting for. And an important aspect here is that there's nothing that exists in the world that necessarily draws us to it, right? So there's not, for instance, there's not some good thing that exists somewhere in, say, the middle of the Congo that all people are inexorably moving towards as the thing that's going to that is good for them. The point he's trying to get at here is we move towards things that we sort of apprehend, that are in front of us, that we have the ability to think of, to bring to our mind. And so just as we have the ability to sort of think about what will make us happy and choose what we're going to, we can also sort of stop thinking about things that will make us happy. We can choose to consider or not consider the individual goods that will make us happy. So the point being here that we can actually have, in a certain sense, knowledge of what will, an actual like knowledge of what will really make us happy in a certain way, and yet choose to think of something else, or to think of it in a different way, so that we don't see it as being good. And this ultimately is what where Aquinas makes room for the possibility of sin, the possibility of doing things that we don't like. I do what I do not want to do. This idea that we have these, you know, there's a broad sense in which we can and should come to know what makes us happy, and yet we find ourselves repeatedly falling into patterns of doing things that don't make us happy. So what the heck is going on there? How is it that we keep finding ourselves falling down these paths? We have such this power of freedom and control. How is it that we keep finding our way into these situations where we're not happy? And there's a way in which his argument is that we can train ourselves to think about reality in a skewed way. That we can choose how it is to think about particular objects, and how it is, and whether to think about them at a particular time, and whether they're going to be good for us. So the point I want to get at with this understand is this sort of, now so this is this fleshing out of the idea of free will in man and its ability to recognize, to seek the good, and to then to influence to move forward is sort of very complicated, even in just sort of St. Thomas' own work and sort of how he describes that. And so I'm not going to claim to that I've done a sufficient job of fleshing this whole thing out. But the broad strokes of what I want to get to express to you are that human beings are complicated, so that we have, in our experience, we have this notion that we have this experience of seeking after what will make us happy, what will be good for us. But we also have, and we also recognize that there are things about us that we can't control. So it's not as if everything about us is completely under our control. That there's this window in which we work, in which we are able to set our mind on certain things and then sort of let our bodies take over. And actually, no, I don't want to say that. That's a bad way to say it, because that sounds way too realistic. There's a way in which we have a certain power over the natural desires in us, that we can see sort of in this as we work up through nature in different ways, these sort of natural tendencies. There's a way in which we have a certain limited control over where we can direct ourselves in certain circumstances, and we can also then think deeply about this, saying, okay, I have this long-term goal I'm aiming towards, and there are all these little things in between that I want to do to get to that point. And so we have there is this inherent connection between our ability to think deeply and our ability to choose. That is because, in fact, it is because we can think deeply that we are able to choose certain patterns of action. And in a certain sense, vice versa. It's only because we have the power to choose that we are able to actually think deeply. That I have the ability to focus my mind on a math problem, and then focus my mind on say, you know, the first step and the second step and the third step. But I have a certain amount of control over how it is that I'm reasoning through reasoning through the solution to some proof, or that I'm working through, that I have the possibility to reason through a debate with someone. That I have the ability to focus the mind on sort of this step-by-step process. The ability to think deeply is inherently linked with the ability, that the possibility of directing the mind. And so that there is this interplay between the ability to think, the ability to reason, and the ability to choose. And that in a certain sense, one doesn't work without the other. So that it is in this sort of limited regime of freedom that we have, this sort of not about the absolute good that we're aiming at, not about every aspect of our bodies, but this sort of this limited window where reason, our ability to think, and our ability to choose is most present and most active. And so this broad picture that St. Thomas paints of how it is that we reason with will is built on the general patterns of nature, the general patterns that we recognize and study in the sciences, and yet also has, in a certain sense, there is something unique about what it is that we as human beings are able to do. But it's not completely antithetical to the way we think about and talk about everything else in reality. It is different, this ability of reasoning and choosing, this ability of thinking and willing, are not, we don't recognize that in the same way and to the degree in anything else in nature, but we can see sort of connections between this unique power, this unique ability that we have, and the general structures of nature we see around us. And we also recognize that our ability to do these things depends very, very much on the physical reality around us. This is just one sort of last point I want to make specifically on this Thomistic understanding of reason and will, is that for St. Thomas and this sort of this classical this Thomistic tradition, the mind, thought, intellectual activity is a spiritual power. It's not inherently seated in quarks and neutrons and physical things. That there is something about reasoning, but that the nature of reasoning itself, the nature of abstract thought, that cannot be simply reduced down to the material world. That's a whole other talk in and of itself, and I'm going to touch on aspects of it here. But the other thing to realize is that thinking and reasoning don't happen without all the quarks and neutrons and physical structures. There is a way in which the ability to think abstractly depends upon our ability to even begin thinking. We have to start to absorb what's going on in reality. We have to have this sense of through our senses, through our ability to see, to touch, to taste, to smell. We begin to sort of feel out the structures of reality. Then we can start to peel off certain pictures and certain aspects of that reality. And the way that Aquinas describes this is that is in fact the very process of reasoning, the way this immaterial power works is in concert with all the physical aspects as well. So that there is when I want to think about a cat, right? If I want to think about the cat, I have an image of the cat kind of popping in my head. I mean, I am both imagining a cat and thinking about a cat. Now, it might be a particular cat for a moment, but I can sort of try to think about cat in the abstract. And what I'm going to get is this weird sort of like stop motion flashy video of like, you know, like a brown, black, green, yellow, spotted, larger, smaller. Like there's this sort of, there's a way in which we can't imagine the abstract cat, but there's a way in which our imagination is constantly at work while we are doing this complicated process of reasoning. And so it is our reasoning and choosing uses all of the physical apparatus, all of the, you know, most especially in the mind, and most especially in our brains, all of the neurons, all of the neurochemistry going on in there. It's not an either or thing. It's a way in which there's a concert, there's a working in concert going on. That's the sort of, now obviously Aquinas doesn't talk about neurons, but he talks about this notion of the role of the brain, the role of the physical, in working in concert with this intellectual and rational power, this intellectual and power and this ability to choose that for various reasons you can argue are not inherently material of themselves. Okay. So I want to step into a little bit just some objections, broadly speaking, to this picture. And again, I'm not going to claim that I've sufficiently either explained this vision of free will. There's just a huge depth to it that's beautiful in the way you can probe it, but also to understand how these objections often belie a certain skewed idea either of free will of nature in a certain way, I guess, I want to say, or the relation thereof. So I, on the back of the sheet, which I put somewhere, hopefully, oh, yeah, so I kind of have just a couple different, two main objections. So the second one kind of can split into two. The first one is a quote from Albert Einstein that sort of is in a letter that he wrote to this, to I think it was a poet. But, so leaving aside the inconsistency of such a review, the influence of alcohol and other sharply controllable factors on our thoughts, feelings, and activities should show very distinctly that determinism does not stop before the majesty of our human will. So this is Einstein, who, you know, hated the sort of the randomness and indeterminacy of quantum mechanics, as is sort of well known. There's nuance there, of course, but that he wanted the world to be deterministic, and he thought that this determinism went, like, plowed through the very notion of free will. And the examples he brings up is the fact that, okay, there are all these physical things going in my body that prevent me from or that overpower my ability to choose, my ability to have control over my choices. And in a certain sense, the objection I would grant, yes, there are all sorts of physical aspects of reality, physical aspects of our body that can prevent us from choosing well. And this is linked to that idea that our ability to think and to choose is not reducible to quarks and neutrons and neurons, but it doesn't work without them either. So that when the one is faulty, it impedes the other. So when you drink too much alcohol and your brain is, then the process by which your imagination works, the process by which you I'm not a neurobiologist. So the exact process, but the effects that alcohol, that drugs might have on our brain, reduce our ability to make both that reasoning process, that process of seeing the pathway by which we want to get to some good, and the ability to choose consistently with that. Where there's this distortion in our ability to imagine and that of the physical order that affects our ability to reason as well, or just, you know, I mean, cases of, I mean, all sorts of brain trauma cases of, but even more simply, I mean, there are physical things that can prevent me from doing what I want. So if I get locked in a cage, obviously I'm not able to go out of that cage, physically impossible to get through there. This idea that we have our will is not is able to be impeded. There's just at base certain things our will can't do that we can't choose about, that don't have freedom over, and there are things that happen in the world to us and at times of our own of our own doing that weaken, that change the way that will works. But this doesn't mean, that doesn't completely destroy the freedom, because the freedom is not inherently about it's not a freedom of sort of absolute power. It's not a freedom to do. It's not a freedom of absolute control. It's a freedom of seeing the of yeah. It's a freedom of laying out the pathway to some goal. So there's a subtle difference there. I want to draw out that yes, there is the possibility of this sort of physical impediment to our power to think, but that need not necessarily destroy our power to choose. That need not necessarily destroy the power of free will altogether. And the second one comes more from our understanding of nature as a whole. And so this is a quote from the same Sabinhoffens, Hassenfelder, sort of actually right afterwards. In summary, according to our best present theories of nature, humans don't have free will in the sense explained above. The first quote about being able to predict, being able to choose different futures, which in my opinion is the only sensible meaning of the phrase, so that meaning of free will. Now you could dismiss this and claim that there must be something about nature then that these theories don't correctly describe, and that's where free will hides, but that's like claiming God hides there. It might be possible to construct theories of nature that allow for free will, but presently have absolutely zero evidence that this is how nature works. For all we know, there just is no free will. So this is not hardly common, but also not uncommon way of thinking. It's like, okay, we have this picture of reality that goes down to the sort of standard model of particle physics. You have, getting into string theory, you have this description, these layers of description that we have so much confidence in, that have been so good for us over so many centuries, that we have so much confidence in them that, in fact, it seems like because there's no obvious way for us to fit what seems to be something antithetical to that picture we've produced, that we have to throw it out. There's no evidence within this type of picture, within the mathematical structure of what we describe in physics for this idea of volition, this idea of our ability to choose how we act. That we have no evidence for it, so we should set it aside and look for a better theory. And I think there are two things I want to. There are two ways I would push back on this a little bit. One is just the picture that we have of how the natural world works, the confidence that we have in the mathematical order, and the sort of the scientific description of reality, is wonderful and beautiful and very powerful, but it's also I would argue part of a larger picture of things. And there are ways in which we can approach these questions from parallel but slightly different paths. So we can talk about, so that the picture we're painting, that I was trying to paint of moving towards ends, that is, again, drawing on and rooted in the scientific order, but also sort of points in a different direction. That is sort of a different type of description. And the other is where does the confidence that we have in the scientific order come from? The confidence that we have in the scientific order comes from our ability to think and reason about the world, our ability to see the world, and not only see the world, but to choose what things in the world to focus on, what things in the world to investigate, what things in the world to draw our attention to, and then to be able to compare them to one another in this very complex reasoning process. And this idea that we could, that reasoning is somehow simply something that happens without some aspect of freedom and control, takes away from the very idea of how do we have, if we lose the possibility of control over how we're reasoning, how do we have confidence in what we're reasoning about? And this kind of comes out in the second quote here by Anton Zellinger, who does kind of, he's specifically talking in reference to a thing called superdeterminism, which comes out of sort of deep investigations of quantum mechanics. Bell's inequality talks about the idea that that there are no hidden variables. So that the world is not fundamentally deterministic. That there has to be some sort of quantum weirdness going on. And it was this Bell put forward this theory that if we make these certain types of measurements, we can find certain measurements that would be impossible if the world had sort of hidden variables that were deterministic. But he actually, in the process of doing that, he made a little caveat. It's like that there are a number of kind of loopholes that could get you out of this inequality. So these observations were made. It was seen that a basic idea of a sort of hidden variables theory of quantum mechanics that really quantum mechanics, the weirdness of quantum mechanics is just that there's something we can't see. There's some aspect of reality we don't have access to that explains why there's all this sort of probabilistic things coming out. And Bell's inequality seems on the face of it to say, no, that can't be right. There's something more fundamental than just like some measurements we can't make, some things we don't have access to directly. But he put forward these various loopholes. And in fact, this Anton Zellinger has done a lot of work in closing those loopholes, like doing experiments to show that many of the kind of the outs you could get from that. In fact, don't work. But one of them is that Bell put forward. So, well, it could simply be that all of this is just linked directly to the initial state of the universe. And so, the very actions of the experimenter in choosing how to run his experiment are completely correlated to the results of the experiment, because they come directly from the initial state of the universe. There's this complete determinism over all of reality. Would somehow tie the very things we do to the results we get, and therefore you no longer have free will. You no longer have actual control over what you're doing. You are actually just part of the experiment, and the results you get then aren't you don't have confidence in the reliability of those results, because you are inherently connected to everything that is. Your actions are inherently connected to all the results you're getting. And he sort of, in response to this loophole, says that we always implicitly assume the freedom of the experimentalist. The fundamental assumption is essential to doing science. If this were not true, then, I suggest, it would make no sense at all to ask nature questions in an experiment, since then nature could determine what our questions are. And that could guide our questions such that we arrive at a false picture of nature. This idea that if we don't actually have control over our ability to think, our ability to choose, our ability to set up experiments, that we don't actually have confidence in the results we're getting. The very notion of having the very sort of possibility of doing, you know, kind of statistics over a large series of samples implies the ability to control the initial conditions going into them, and having confidence that these initial that you can vary these initial conditions independent of other changes. But if there is this, if we don't actually have that ability to change and control, then it at least brings into question all the results we're getting. And this kind of comes out most clearly, I think, if you think about sort of the determinism that comes out in sort of a many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. So the many worlds interpretation, for those who don't know, it's basically that anytime two possible things can happen, both happen. It's sort of the universe splits into two. There are reasons that this, I mean, that's very quick and dirty. There's nuance there, but this idea that there's this sort of every possibility is actually instantiated, and we just happen to be on one of these paths, one of these universes, and so we just don't notice the fact that there are all these other universes out there, that are these other worlds out there, that all these paths are going on. But then the difficulty there is that, okay, if that's the case, then there is some universe, you know, I mean, in African sense, where every single die roll ever has come up as a 6, right? The chances that we're, you know, if you just, you know, again, statistically, the chances we're in that universe are pretty small. In fact, we know we're not in the universe because we've seen dies change. But the idea that if there is no actual freedom to affect the future, if there's a way in which, then there is sort of this possibility that all of the sort of the all of the results we've been getting are actually skewed in a way we never even realized, because we don't actually have that control to search for the ability to try to search for and weed out the ways those are skewed. A similar kind of thing can be talked about for even if you set aside the possibility of determinism, even in quantum mechanics, an interpretation that would have sort of an inherent indeterminacy in the reality. So Hassenfelder is sort of including that in this. So even in that picture, you can't have free will because quantum mechanics says it's purely random. There is no actual sort of space for any sort of control from the outside by anything like free will. While I would argue that in a certain sense the indeterminate picture is more conducive to an idea of free will than the other, I don't want to say that it's quantum mechanics that causes free will or something like that. That's a too strong a sense of a word. But the point I want to get at here is that Hassenfelder begins from the assumption of the completeness of a material description of reality based on the success of all that we've learned in modern science, and the great success we've had in modern science, and reasons from that there can no longer be this notion of free will, and that therefore this doesn't fit into the structure we've built up, so we're going to throw the free will away. What I want to argue is there's an alternative, right? That And in fact, we kind of need that alternative because of the role that free will has in our ability to know reality, to reason about nature, that our picture that we build up in the sciences is wonderful and beautiful and coherent, and yet part of a larger structure. Part of a larger structure that includes not simply the quarks and the neutrons, but something more that has some way of interacting with them, but that interaction might not be on the terms that the scientific theory describes. In the sense that it may not simply be an extra term in the standard model of particle physics, or it might not be a particular sort of aspect of quantum mechanics or a particular aspect of neurobiology, that we may not actually be able to observe simply by looking at the material aspect the impact of this directly. But that doesn't mean that need not necessarily close off the completeness of what we want to talk about. So that in a certain sense we can have everything, we can have so much of what Hassenfelder wants, and we can have just our common experience and the reality that we see of our ability to choose and think, if we're willing to see all the material, the things that we learn in modern science, as part of this larger structure. And so there are times when it's helpful to sort of set aside the other parts and focus on the material. And there's times when it's helpful to set aside the material and think about others, and times sort of to look for the lines in between and try and see where they come together. But that that this is in fact a fuller picture and in a certain sense a more open picture of reality. So I want to close with just an image that I love from G.K. Chesterton, because Chesterton talks about this idea that sometimes you get this notion that that say a particular, you know, so Christianity or Catholicism is a closed worldview, that it forces you to think in certain ways and to avoid certain questions, and it closes you in, and it closes you off to the beauty and wonder and the fullness of reality. And Chesterton's point is, well, in a certain sense, well, yeah, of course Christianity is a closed worldview in a certain sense, because is, say, a view that claims that everything is simply material. Because if I'm going to claim that, if I'm going to claim that this is true, I have to say this other thing is false. That whatever picture we have of reality, it's going to be limited, and it's going to sort of close the way we think about reality and say, okay, this has to be correct and this has to be false. If I say that God exists, then I can't also say that God doesn't exist. I have to sort of, you know, pick one or the other in certain ways. And then he goes on to say, that in fact, if you compare then, say, the sort of Christian view of things to a more materialistic view of things, that the Christian is actually more open to the possibilities of reality. And he has this line that the Christian is quite free to believe that there is a considerable amount of settled order and inevitable development in the universe. But the materialist is not allowed to admit into his spotless machine the slightest speck of spiritualism or miracle. Spiritual doctrines do not actually limit the mind as do the materialistic denials. Even if I believe in immortality, I need not think about it at any particular moment. But if I disbelieve in immortality, I must not think about it at all, ever. In the first case, the road is open and I can go as far as I like. In the second, the road is shut. He's being a little forceful there in certain ways, but there's a way in which I want to argue that whereas Hassenfelder and along those lines is starting from this position of, we have all this beautiful picture of the scientific order, and it's wonderful and amazing, and I don't want to, we don't see how free will fits into it, so we have to set free will aside, and so we have to give that up. What I'm saying is that if we start from the position of our common experience of what free will, that the possibility of our choosing and the role that has, we can have the beautiful structure and order of science as well. In fact, we can have that and more. That these things need not be completely at conflict. So getting back to the title of the talk, is there room in physics for free will? Does physics leave any room for free will? Yes and no. No, in the sense that, is there going to be free will, like an equation for free will in your physics? Is there going to be some is there going to be some new particle that describes how free will is, or is like with Descartes, which is awesome? Are we going to suddenly find the pituitary gland? This one little piece of the brain is actually this is the physical place where the mind and the body interact. It's like, no, I don't. That's not the claim I want to make. But that physics does leave room for free will, and that free will is in one way necessary for the very possibility of physics, and opens the things that we know in physics up to a wider reality. So by opening up the possibility of things like free will, and there is an opening of the mind to a broader picture of reality that need not destroy the beauty of the scientific structure, but actually sort of that enlivens it. So I've been talking too long, so I'm going to stop. So thank you very much.